Blog Talk Radio.
To find an answer on the road.
shared that song. Thank you, Elton John. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Liberty Bell Hour, where we're letting freedom ring here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Daria DiGiovanni, and I want to thank you for joining me again this evening. Before I get to my wonderful guest, who I know you're going to really enjoy, if you have not heard her speak before, she's fabulous, and you're going to learn a lot from her. Her name is Alexandria Merrill, and she is the author of a book called Rules for Republican Radicals. And it's basically a guidebook on how to sort of take a page out of the left's playbook and kind of use their rules against them in a very nonviolent way, of course, but to sort of take the basic philosophy of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals and kind of use them in the fight for freedom. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with Alexandria tonight about her book and also about her latest column, because in light of this latest Vanity Fair hit piece on Sarah Palin, and just in light of the moral bankruptcy of feminism in general in today's culture, her latest column, I think, is spot on. And I read that at her website today at alexandriamerrill.com, and I posted a link to it in the chat room. So I'm definitely going to ask her to expound upon that a little bit, because I found it fascinating, and I think she hit on all of the right points and really talked about all that's wrong with the alleged feminist movement and really the dire consequences, I think, of what that has wrought upon us and upon our culture. But before I get to that, I just want to mention that today is September 2nd, and we're exactly 2 months away from fundamentally taking back our country. And I can't wait. I cannot wait for the November midterm elections. Just so excited. Here in Florida, of course, among other candidates, I'm supporting Marco Rubio for Senate. Can't wait to vote for him. In Florida, Congressional District 22, where I live, I'll be voting for Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. So excited about that. And also we'll be strongly supporting Pam Bondi for Attorney General. I'm actually hoping to be able to bring her on to either the Liberty Bell Hour or the Blog Talk Radio show that I co-host with my good friend Stephen Rosenblum, Conservative Republican Forum, at 6 p.m. on Saturdays. Now, Steve, of course, is also running for State House in Florida in District 89, and I encourage you all, and I will put the link up in the chat room, to check out his site at electrosenblum.com, because we really need to get good common sense people into our state legislatures, and into our governor's offices, as well as into Congress. And so I'm real excited about everything that's going on. And I want to also mention this week just how exciting was that Alaska election, the results from Alaska the other night, just astounding. Congratulations to Joe Miller, who's a fantastic candidate, to the Tea Party Express, who I know has been traveling the state of Alaska and supported that candidate with money and by going around there and really getting the word out about him. And also, of course, to Sarah Palin, Sarah and Todd Palin. And I'm just so happy to see really a true conservative, someone who truly will uphold the Constitution. And he himself said he will be looking at any bill, and the first question he's going to ask himself is this constitutional, before voting for something? So how nice will it be to have a representative in Congress who will actually abide by our United States Constitution? I can hardly wait. So I can hardly wait to get him and Marco Rubio and others elected. So I just wanted to say congratulations to Joe Miller. I was up really late the other night just waiting for those results to come in, and it really sunk in that I am definitely a political junkie, but I actually prefer to call myself a passionate patriot. And, it's great to, it's great to love your country. It's great to work on yourself and to put your faith in God. But we also have to, as Mark Levin said, sort of channel that energy where it counts, and that's into supporting these men and women of integrity who have put everything on hold, their careers and their lives, to run for office and to really make a change, a change we can truly believe in, a change back to our constitutional roots. And so it's just really exciting. I mean, I can't think of any other election that I've been so excited about. And this one really, as we know, I mean, they say this every 2 years or every time an election rolls around, but this one is absolutely critical. So I'm just psyched. So congratulations to Joe Miller. And a little bit about Alexandria Merrill before I go ahead and bring her on. Her background, she has a background in political science and economics. She actually grew up in the Midwest, the oldest child of a military aviator and his wife, who is a university professor and author. And at the age of 18, Alexandria moved to Boston to pursue a career in journalism as a foreign correspondent. But faced with a years-long waiting list for the program, at 19, she relocated to New York City, where she attended Hofstra University and New York University. And she spent her early career pursuing acting while writing business articles, corporate portfolios, and customer service manuals for the financial and property industries. So she's definitely a diverse and interesting, accomplished woman. And throughout her 20s and 30s, with three children and working in several different industries, Alexandria continued to write. And she's penned multiple drama screenplays and has researched and written several documentaries focusing on social issues. One such documentary focused on the failure of antiquated anti-stalking laws to protect people from modern-day electronic and internet stalking, and that led to her being offered a place at film school. During her tenure as a mature student, Merrill focused on writing and producing projects about criminal justice reform, civil rights, First Amendment limitations, and politics, culminating in her dissertation, televised for the Court of Public Opinion, Disintegrating Civil Rights in Exposé Television, which focused on the media's usurpation of people's rights to be presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Almost two decades after originally leaving school, Merrill graduated with a master's degree in television and film project development. She then attended law school before returning to writing full-time. Wow. She's pretty amazing. In 2008, Alexandria Merrill began writing about the ethical and legal irregularities in the presidential campaign in her blog, Republican. Continued reference by Obama and his wife to Saul Alinsky led Merrill to research the corporate terrorist and the link between his organization and Obama. What she discovered was shocking, leading her to write Rules for Republican Radicals, which dissects the tactics and techniques used by Team Obama to manipulate the media and voters. Alexandria Merrill continues to write about politics from a conservative perspective, both contributing daily commentary and opinions on events that affect Americans and providing guidance to those who wish to become involved in politics or organize conservative political organizations. She also continues to write both fiction and factual pieces for print media and producing projects for film and television. And I see that she's not on the line with us yet, so while I'm waiting for her to call in, and I know that I confirmed with her, so I'm sure she will be calling in any moment. So there's the fun of internet radio. I get to be spontaneous now. So I see that in the chat room my good friend Don is mentioning the Scott Brown election. And yeah, and that's very true. I think one of the things that the Tea Party's been very careful about, I think, was in, you know, carefully selecting their candidates. And obviously Scott Brown is not a true blue conservative in the sense that any real Reagan conservative or Palin conservative would want. However, he was the electable candidate in Massachusetts. And so even though we've intensely disliked, I'll put it that way, many of his voting decisions, I think we can all agree that having an elected representative in office with whom we can agree maybe 75% to 80% of the time is a heck of a lot better than having a Democrat who we're going to virulently disagree with maybe 95% to 100% of the time. And I think that really there's a larger issue here besides winning elections. I think that what's needed and what's so great about Glenn Beck is that he's kind of leading the way. We really need a total restoration in this country because while conservatives were busy working, raising families, going to church, you know, living normal, upstanding lives, the left was busy taking over pop culture and taking over the media and taking over on public education. And so the result is an electorate that really doesn't know how to think for itself, that doesn't really understand the foundations of our country and what people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were all about. I mean, we've lost the whole concept of American exceptionalism and why we are the greatest country on the face of the earth and why we don't need to apologize to anyone. That this country, while we've had our problems and we've had our own sins that we've committed, that we've always been a country that's admitted to our mistakes and moved forward. And so we have a lot to be proud of. We are a beacon of freedom in the world. And all these countries that quote-unquote hate us or criticize us, such as the Europeans, yeah, they like to bask in our protection. So just remember that. But the bottom line is we have a lot of educating to do. And that's sort of a long-term project. So in the meantime, in the case of a state like Massachusetts, Scott Brown was the best we were going to do, and we have to kind of focus on, we have to choose our battles wisely, I'll put it that way. Joe Miller can win in a state like Alaska, and he's a fantastic candidate. And so we have to make sure that we are, we're smart about it. And, hey, I see that I have a caller on the line. I don't believe it's Alexandria Merrill. I think I know who this is, so let me go ahead and bring him on. Caller, good evening. You are live on the Liberty Bell Hour.
Is this Daria?
This is Daria.
Daria, hi. This is Don. Yes.
Hey, Don.
Hey, I hope you don't mind. I just wanted to take a moment and just call in, and I, too, wanted to say that I 100% agree with you about Joe Miller. I'm extremely happy that he won. And, however, I wanted to ask your opinion on something that I was concerned about. In this day and age, though, you're not seeing wins by huge margins. And that was one of the things that concerned me because, like, basically went off to a runoff. It was basically went to a runoff between Murkowski and Miller. And it's what's frightening me is these days we don't have politicians that lose gracefully. They don't go, okay, the people have spoken. Have a good night, everyone. And I'm getting concerned about that. I mean, I will say this, I was quite surprised. Corzine bowed out, but only because he lost by 100,000 votes in New Jersey. And when you're doing a statewide thing, that's a big deal. But these huge majorities, I really hope that we see more huge majorities like this, not because I really want us to win big or what have you, or because I think they deserve that, but because I just don't trust people that lose these days. And I was curious your thoughts on that.
Right. Well, you know, you bring up a lot of good points, Don, and just let's look at Alaska specifically first. You know, Joe Miller only entered this race, I believe, in June. And, you know, Lisa Murkowski was the daughter of Ted Murkowski, but her father. My God, she's a horrible first name escaped me at the moment. But Sarah Palin actually defeated her father to win the governor's race in 2006.
Right.
And she herself was, you know, what I find, even among some conservatives, among the grassroots, is there are a lot of people that still like their pork, and they like politicians who are going to bring home their pork. I will point to Jack Murtha, who has since passed away, but, you know, that district in Pennsylvania where, although they are very conservative, they may be registered Democrats, most of them, but they are, you know, pro-military, pro-gun. They're conservative in many, many important ways. The reason he kept getting reelected was because he could bring home the pork. So there's a certain element of that, and I think that was at play in Alaska. And Murkowski, of course, had their name recognition. And so, you know, actually, we really should look at it as, you know, no one really fought, even people that were supporting Joe Miller. I mean, I think they would have been thrilled if it was close and if he had still lost. And now it was close, but he actually pulled out a victory. He pulled off a victory. And so this was really, you know, the upstart conservative going against, you know, the establishmentarian, if I might use Angelo Cotavilla's term, and, you know, the member of the ruling class Republicans. And, you know, and he still won. And so, you know, I see your point. And, again, I think it's going to be a combination of a lot of different things that's going to, you know, in the future determine larger margins of victory, you know, and that kind of goes back to what I was saying about sort of re-educating the electorate and helping people to understand what government's proper role is according to our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, I think that now that Joe Miller has won and he can move forward and go into, you know, general, you know, campaign mode, I really think you're going to see him start to pull ahead in that race. As far as New England, you know, Don, all I can say is I'm really, it's hard to believe that New England played such a role in the founding of our country because
right.
they've certainly come a long way since the Pilgrims.
Right.
So, you know, if Scott Brown was the best we could do, I'd say, listen, he's ticked me off a lot this year. However, do I prefer him over Martha Coakley? Absolutely. Do I hope that maybe we can change the culture over time, that someone who's a little further to the right than Scott Brown can win decisively in Massachusetts? Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So, because the thing that frightens me is just that, like, give the best example is the New York District, what was it, 22, the one that had Didi Scosafaza?
New York
there?
23, yes.
Yes, New York 23. By the way, the best thing that came out of that election was that everybody in the United States learned how to pronounce her name properly except me. So, but no. In all sincerity, though, but the thing was is that she didn't go out gracefully. You know what I mean? Like, when it came time for her to go, okay, I'm bowing out, she bows out. And instead of basically going, because, like, the fact of the matter is that with the three-party system that they had there, it was basically more or less a Republican-conservative coalition over here versus the pretty much hand-picked Obama Democrat. And basically when she went out, she basically said, you know what, everybody vote for the Democrat. Okay, thank you. And to be honest with you, that one issue alone right there, I mean, it was so terrible, it has now cost Newt Gingrich, I honestly think, from ever being a viable Republican candidate
sure.
ever again because he supported her. And people will sure. throw that back in his face if he were to announce that he's running again.
Well, I'd say they'd throw that in his face along with him sitting on the couch with Nancy back in 2007 over, you know, climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and a little bit, you know, like it or not, a little bit of his past, you know, in terms of, you know, his ex-wife having cancer and him leaving her. And I'm, for better or for worse, people are going to bring up those things.
Right.
But, I think that he put the final nail in the coffin by supporting Scosafaza. I mean, she was to the left of the Democrat in the race.
Right.
You know, she supported Karchek. I mean, there was nothing about this woman that said Republican except for the R after her name. And
right.
that was a really – New York 23 is a really unique case. And that was also a situation where you had Fred and Jerry Thompson jumping in and Club for Growth, and along with Sarah Palin behind Doug Hoffman. And look, he almost pulled that off. Now that's a very conservative district, by everything that I've read. And you know, and the problem was that I guess with the timing and the way it all went down, Scosafaza's name was still on the ballot, which would be confusing to a lot of people if they weren't really paying attention and they were there to vote for the Republicans.
Right.
So, but look how close he came anyway. So I think that says
a lot
about the mood of the country.
Right. No, I know. I mean, like, in very much, though, it was a win considering that he was this, I don't want to say a nobody that nobody had ever heard of, but he was a nobody that nobody had ever heard of against, because if I remember correct, didn't Didi, I dare not pronounce her last name again.
Just call it Scuzzy.
But didn't Didi have...
Fozzy.
Yeah. Didi Fozzie Bear of I'm sorry, I shouldn't do that. but she had a name recognition that he didn't have. And so, I mean, like,
correct.
Everything about that was a victory. But what I'm simply saying is that there are just so many of these rhinos that I'm really concerned about. And, like, now that Murkowski basically got dumped by Miller, I wouldn't be surprised if on the way out she basically says, like, yes to everything Obama wants to do. Like, I could honestly see Rahm Emanuel picking up the phone one night and going, let's do business. You've got a shelf life. We can help each other out. We will send positive press your way with the New York Press, I mean with the New York Times, with the Los Angeles Times. We'll even get you on a couple of morning shows speaking nice about you or something like that mm-hmm. on Sunday. All you have to do is just rubber stamp this, this, and this. And then basically what happens is that now in the future, whenever any of these, like, government growing socialist policies then come forward and say, hey, look, we got a bipartisan majority here. Voinovich supported this. Murkowski supported this. And it's sort of like it makes it a tad bit disingenuous to what they mean. So that's my other concern about this as well. If we actually lived in a place where people lost gracefully, and I just don't see that. I mean, like, even the whole time, I mean, like, just because I was watching the way she was, and during the recount, I mean, she was trashing Miller every which way. Oh, he's ruining the process. He's ruining this. He's ruining that. And I was like, wow, you've got a level of class to you, don't you?
Yeah. I know, and your point is a good one. You know, and I would just say that we were always running the risk of that happening in that lame duck session, and I'll just say that it's just more things that we'll need to hold all of these new people accountable for undoing once they are sworn in January.
Yeah.
But it's worth making the effort to, you know, we have to do what we have to do. I mean, the Tea Party movement, grassroots conservatives, we are out there, we're doing what needs to be done, we're supporting good candidates, we're out there protesting, we're precinct walking, making phone calls on behalf of candidates, we're doing all the things that need to be done, including forums like this and talking about the issues and now reaching out to, you know, friends and neighbors and maybe discussing politics with people that you wouldn't ordinarily discuss them with. You know, that was always going to be a given no matter what. So, you know, we still have to do what we have to do. And it's absolutely a valid point. I mean, they could try to ram through anything they want in that lame duck session, especially if things go the way, according to what Pat Caddell and a lot of these people are saying. I mean, you know, and I hate to, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic. I hate to just be like, oh, yeah, it's going to be a tidal wave bigger than 94. You know, it's going to be a bloodbath for the Democrats, even though Charlie Cook and Gallup and Rasmussen and all of these reputable firms are saying that. There's still a part of me that wants to just keep working as if we're 20 points behind. But if we do see that, then, yeah, you're going to see the final throes. And I think we're seeing it already now, not in terms of voting for odious legislation, but in terms of just things that have been happening.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing the final death throes of the left. I mean, look at this guy yesterday taking hostages at the Discovery Channel. Now, please keep in mind, I'm not blaming this. I'm not saying it's Al Gore's fault that this guy's a kook and he went crazy.
Yeah.
What I'm simply saying is the mindset of these lefties who buy into those policies can cause some of them to do crazy things.
I got to be honest with you. Between you and me, I think I'm on the verge of losing a friendship over this very discussion. I was talking with a very dear friend of mine on Facebook who basically is someone that supports President Obama, and he admitted that he's an atheist and everything to me, and he tore into me because I am a Christian, because I am a Republican. And I don't think... He tore into what he was experiencing, and the only thing I couldn't even argue with him. I mean, because it would have been pointless. It was one of those times where it was just kind of like, it was this level of, this stinks. He basically said, he's like, we're sending guys our age over to war, and 70% of the people in our age bracket are dying in Iraq for no reason, and we're not getting health care. And I didn't want to argue with him because I don't know how quite to describe it, and I didn't call to commiserate about my problems. But I'm amazed that I'm actually at the point where I'm losing friendships or on the border of losing friendships because of political views. And I'm so dumbfounded by that. I mean, people that know me know that a lot of my friends are like, some of my friends are into psychics. Some of my friends are lesbians. Some of my friends are pagans. Some of my friends hate comic books. I mean, the woman that I love and I'm spending the rest of my life with, or at least I'm begging her to keep spending the rest of my life with her, she's supportive of me, but she's kind of like, comic books aren't my thing. She has her other interests and stuff, and it's sort of like, it's just, I don't know, it's just, there's such a level of hostility on the left
for Republicans,
and it really breaks my heart. It really does, because friendships are being ruined because of it.
Yeah, listen, I feel your pain, Don. Something that that Alan West said, and I've had the privilege of seeing him many times, you know, give a speech, you know, being present when he's speaking at an event or a tea party or what have you. And I remember, gosh, this has to be about 2 years ago at a particular meeting that I was at. He was talking about this very thing, and he said, look, there's about 30% of the population that's just, they're gone, you know, and referring to that hardcore left. And he said, you know, those aren't even the people to even worry about. And I understand your point, because it really gets dicey when you're talking about dear friends or family. But he said, you know, in terms of persuading them and trying to even engage them on the issues, you might as well just give up. I mean, for me, it's kind of like trying to rationally deal with a 9/11 truther and mm-hmm. present them with fact after fact after fact, and every, you know, engineering studies from Purdue University, and no matter what you tell them, because the mind of a conspiracy theorist, they're just never going to get it, because that's their thing. They believe in crazy conspiracy theories, and you know, the facts be damned. I think what we need to focus on are the people who are persuadable, maybe people who aren't necessarily involved in politics, but they're kind of seeing what's going on, and it's making them very uneasy. They don't really like big government. They like the government to be smaller. Those are the types of people that we need to really engage and try to persuade and educate. And I'll tell you, like, from participating in the weekly tea party in Fort Lauderdale, it was a great location. It's a great location because it's at the corner of a big, huge shopping center right on Federal Highway and Oakland Park Boulevard. And there's a big Target, and it's just a huge, long, sprawling shopping center. So there's a lot of cars, you know, parking. There's people walking on foot. And I can't tell you over the course of the last 18, 19 months how many people we've been able to talk to who come up to us and say, you know what, I just saw your sign. I know, I'm against Obamacare, too. I don't want socialized medicine, or, you know, I support the military. You're absolutely right. And those are the people that we've talked to and say, yeah, tell me more about candidates. I want to get more involved. So those are the kind of people that I'm talking about, because, you know, somebody who's like your friend, they're just too far gone. So we need to keep that in mind. But, hey, Don, I want to thank you for the call. You're welcome to stay on the line, but I believe my guest, Alexandria Merrill, may be here. So stay on the line, Don, and I'm going to just bring in this caller, and hopefully it's Alexandria.
Okay. Hi, Daria.
Good evening. Hi, Alexandria. How are you?
I'm so sorry. I can't tell you how crazy it's been over here. I'm on the road, and so I'm on the last part of my book tour, and so things do not always go as planned. So I'm very sorry that I'm late, but but I'm here
not
now.
Not a problem at all. Well, it's great to have you here. And, you know, I gave you a nice introduction. I read a little bit of your bio from your website.
Thank
so
you.
Why don't we go ahead without further ado, and let's start with, you know, Rules for Republican Radicals, and why don't you tell everybody, you know, what inspired you to write that, and then we can kind of go from there and maybe share with them some practical ways that they can put that advice to good use.
Okay. Well, I'll start out by saying that I didn't consider myself a political person. You know, I didn't set out to, you know, to be a political commentator. I was actually, 2 years ago when I started, in 2008 when I started writing this, I was actually working in the UK writing documentaries for the BBC. And I was working on something about Mike Nifong, who was I don't know if you remember the Duke LaCrosse rape case, where the prosecutor...
Yes, I do.
Right, exactly. The prosecutor knew that these college kids were innocent, but continued to prosecute them because he got so much political juice from it, and he was trying to launch a political campaign. And prior to that, nobody had paid any attention to him, but as soon as, you know, he started to hit the airwaves with this this concept that he was going to be, you know, the sort of sword and shield of black people against white oppression, then he got a tremendous amount of mainstream media coverage and a lot of money. And so I was doing a documentary about this. I was working on researching a documentary about this, and I started to think, I wonder how many politicians have been able to sort of leap into the limelight on the back of one big case. And I was horrified to find out that there's lots of them. And it was about this time that Barack Obama sort of erupted on the scene, and I, having been in Europe for a couple of years prior to that, had never even heard of him. And so I started paying attention to the things that he was saying. And, you know, if you, you know, back 2 years ago, before we really knew very much about this guy, here was this, you know, this historic event. Here is the first black person that was potentially going to be president, or at least he was going to run for presidency. And so I started listening to the sort of things that he was saying. And I was really stunned because, you know, when you are trying to launch a political campaign, especially if you're a virtually unknown person, then the kind of things that you do are you align yourself with somebody who, an iconic figure from the past. You know, you might align yourself with Abraham Lincoln or Ronald Reagan or, you know, or whoever. But what he was doing was aligning himself and saying that that he and his wife identified Sal Alinsky as the most influential person in their life. Having gone, I studied political science in university, and I went on to get a master's degree, and having studied political science in university, I remembered, hey, wasn't Sal Alinsky a bad guy? And so I started to look at more about Sal Alinsky. I thought, well, you know, maybe I don't remember this so well. And I started to research, and I started to look at the tactics used by Sal Alinsky. And he wrote a book entitled Rules for Radicals. For people that aren't familiar with Sal Alinsky, today when you see Black Panthers intimidating people at polling stations, that's a Sal Alinsky tactic. Right now, somebody just sent me over some photos of a bunch of Muslims praying outside in front of mosques in New York City. Where I'm from New York, but I'm not in New York right now. And the idea is that they would be able to stop traffic by, you know, several times a day going out and laying out in the streets to pray. And that's a Sal Alinsky tactic. You know, it's about disruption. It's about creating the sort of feeling that there's just millions of people on your side. The Million Man March was a Sal Alinsky tactic. And, you know, the other thing that Sal Alinsky is credited with is the welfare generation. He was perhaps not 100% responsible, but certainly somebody who went into the inner cities and preached this idea of entitlement and of that poor people really aren't smart enough to be able to better themselves, so the government owes you. And he was very, very successful at essentially domestic terrorism, where he would use these people, primarily poor people, to create what he called an army of idiots and use those people in order to influence the government or businesses and for the most part earn himself a nice living. Al Sharpton is somebody who follows those rules. Al Sharpton, for those of you who don't know, will go to a corporation like Coca-Cola or Pepsi or Ford and say, I speak for blacks. If you don't hire me as a consultant for $250,000 a year, I'm going to go and use the black dollar, which he calls it, and we're going to boycott you for institutional racism. And then the corporations say, oh, gosh, is it worth it for us to have to deal with bad reputation and have to deal with the fallout, or is it cheaper for us to just give this guy the money? And so hundreds of corporations just give him the money. And that's a Sal Alinsky tactic. And so when I started looking at Sal Alinsky, I discovered that some people that are in prominence were students of Sal Alinsky. His most famous student, actually a personal student where he had a personal relationship, was Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton went and trained with Sal Alinsky at his school. He set up a foundation which ultimately became the model for ACORN. Barack Obama, from the moment he got out of college in New York, has worked for a Sal Alinsky-ite organization, and he spent his time in Chicago teaching Sal Alinsky methods. So this is somebody who didn't just come across, you know, an interesting passage in a book and say, hey, yeah, that resonates with me. This is a guy who spent his entire adult life preaching the domestic and corporate terrorist tactics that Sal Alinsky developed. And so when I was writing about Sal Alinsky and I was writing the book, what I've done essentially is taken the rules that Alinsky outlined. Here are the rules for societal manipulation and societal overthrow. And I've explained the rules, I've explained how they work, and then I've given examples on how Team Obama has used those rules effectively. Because I really believe that, you know, conservatives can play a great game, but if they're not playing the same game that Washington is playing, there's no way that they can win. And I don't mean that people should emulate the horrible manipulations and the nasty tactics and the unethical behavior, but you do have to be aware of what those are or you're completely unprotected. And the Republicans,
right,
I feel, have spent the last 2 years essentially chasing after one distraction or another because there's just so much stuff going on and not really being able to deal with the real core issues. And again, that's a Sal Alinsky tactic. So my book really is about identifying these things and then how to organize in such a way so that you aren't diverted by all the distractions, so that you can maintain core values. And I talk a lot about, because there's so many people that are coming on the political scene now as non-political people, you know, people that were doctors or teachers or ditch diggers or whatever, that are throwing their hat into the ring and saying, you know, I am not going to stand for this anymore. And a lot of it is about how those people can stay focused on doing the job that the government is supposed to do and not fall into the sort of trap of just agreeing with the powers that be. And that's pretty much the basis of the book. And I've spent the last couple months doing radio and speaking at various GOP events, and you know, it's been very exciting for me, and unfortunately horrifying that we have to be in this situation.
Oh, absolutely, I agree with you. Now, I do have a caller on the line who wants to ask you a question, but I just want to ask you before I bring him on: are you finding that people are receptive to the message and they're really sort of embracing what you have to say and excited and fired up about kind of getting out there and putting this into practice?
I was really surprised because, like I said, I don't come from a political background, so the focus of this book originally was just sort of a documentary research project, and it just took on a life of its own. And I was surprised when I've met politicians all over the country, and I was surprised how many of them are completely unaware of not only what their role is supposed to be and how to implement that role, but even how the political system works. Most people, you know, just weren't aware the number of precinct seats that were empty. When I wrote the book, I think there were 200,000 precinct seats that were empty across the United States for Republicans. And, you know, if your seat is empty, then the only person that's voting is the Democrat. And so we can't be surprised that, that they've really sort of directed the country because there was no opposition. The other thing that I found really interesting is that the higher-end people in the Republican Party are not really thrilled with my message because I really take them to task, and I talk about the problems with the GOP and the problems with some of the people that are in power. But the people that are on the sort of local and state level have been extremely receptive and have been very interested in talking to me and putting things in practice, and so it's been very, very exciting.
Excellent. Well, that sounds great. Well, I know we're running low on time, so let me go ahead and bring on this caller.
Okay.
I believe it's my good friend Don Smith, and he has a question for you. So,
okay.
Don, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey.
Thank you so much. First of all, I got to tell you, I was deeply disappointed to see my library system does not have your book, so I'm going to have to do something about that.
Well, thank you.
Secondly, I wanted to ask, though, in regards to the Al Sharpton tactic of corporations and stuff, there's almost this corporate appeasement level. I imagine on some level, like the CEO of Coca-Cola and the CEO of McDonald's and the CEO of ExxonMobil, they get together because they get being CEOs of multi-billion-dollar corporations. Wouldn't it occur to any of them to talk like, hey, you know who's been bugging us, that Al Sharpton guy? Yeah, he's been bugging us. Wouldn't it occur to any of these guys to just kind of basically say, yeah, that's it, no more?
I agree. I think, though, that part of it comes down to economic fear of being the one that makes the stand. And if you are essentially beholden to shareholders and your share price drops on, you know, on your watch, it becomes problematic for you. I think, though, that there are more and more people that are saying, you know, wait a minute, I'm not willing to do this. But, you know, mm-hmm. he spent the entirety of his adult life essentially, you know, manipulating Martin Luther King's sort of vision to his own financial gain. And, you know, he's certainly not the only one. Jesse Jackson is another one that's done this. And there are mm-hmm. there are others as well. But I think that it just comes down to corporate culture. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to lose out your share position, especially mm-hmm. when the economy is tight, by making a stand.
Right.
But part of it is, you know, also Americans in particular have spent the better part of the last 30 years teaching appeasement techniques about minorities. And it really comes down to, I mean, how many what's the worst thing that you could say about somebody? They're a racist. And there's nothing that you could come back from that. And so people do everything that they can to avoid that. Exactly. But people do everything they can to avoid having that label attached to them because it's almost impossible to prove otherwise. And that's actually an Alinsky tactic, too. One of his rules is that ridicule is impossible to defend. And so at every point, ridicule your opponent. And they did an excellent job at ridiculing Sarah Palin. And whether you support Sarah Palin or not, they pushed Tina Fey as being Sarah Palin. And, you know, so her caricature and her, the way that she phrased things, it didn't make any difference that Palin didn't say those things. Because they used this ridicule technique, there was really not a whole lot that she could say or do otherwise. And it's the same thing. You know, if I call you a racist, there's really no way to defend yourself. I mean, you could say, oh, but I have black friends, or I have Latino friends, or I speak Spanish, or whatever. That it doesn't make any difference. I mean, that's the big bad word.
Right. One last thing I wanted to ask, and then I will get off. And Daria, great show. Do you think that Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and all of these guys, that their power is diminishing, that people are looking at them as the jokes that they really are?
I do. I think that, you know, they have taught not only blacks, but poor people pretty much across the board for the last 30 or 40 years. They've taught them that they're not smart enough to do without a handout. And I think a lot of people are saying, you know, hey, wait a minute, I really am. I really can do this without a handout. And I think you're seeing a huge increase in minority participation in politics, particularly in conservative circles. And part of it is as mm-hmm. people that were on the sort of lower echelon of society financially, as they start to make it, their value system changes. And their value changes from the I'm entitled to everything because I'm not good enough to the I'm going to stand on my own 2 feet because I am good enough. And when that shift happens, those people by and large become conservative. Now, they tend to be conservative in the middle, but they're centrist on the right-hand side. And so people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton right now, Al Sharpton today announced that he was going to reach out and use his powers to help the Muslim community. He is doing whatever he can to try to pull in as many people as he can to replace the sort of diminishing appeal that he has to the poor. But eventually, you know, these kind of people have been around forever, but his power, you know, dissipates as time goes by.
Oh, great. Alexandra, thank you very much for your time, and
thanks
I really appreciate it. And Daria, again, great show. I'm going to listen along.
Thanks,
all right, take care. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks for the call. Okay,
bye.
Take care. Now, Alexandra, one question I also want to get in for my friend Helene in the chat room, because you mentioned we brought up the Muslim community, and you mentioned that you lived in the U.K., she kind of wanted to know, you know, we read about that, not in the mainstream media, but certainly on the blogs, about how Sharia law is kind of taking over in Europe. And what was your experience there? Did you notice that as well?
Well, it was very strange because I've lived all over the UK from working. You sort of, BBC has offices all over, so you sort of move around and I was a freelancer, so I sort of moved where the jobs were. And for a while, I lived in Glasgow, which has a very high population of Pakistani. And not knowing Glasgow at all, I asked the real estate person to find me an appropriate house for me and my kids, and they found a house in a neighborhood that was almost entirely Pakistani. So there was this sort of middle-class white family, and everybody was Pakistani. Now, having lived all over the world, I thought, oh, great, this will be a great way for my kids to be able to you know, experience another culture. And for the most part, people were very, very lovely, very kind. They were very warm until they weren't. And my oldest son was walking down the street, 3 in the afternoon. We lived in a high-rise building, and so 2 buildings away was a little 7-Eleven shop. And he went down to get a Coke. And when he came out, this group of Pakistani boys and young men were running down the road, saw that he was, you know, he's a blonde-haired, you know, very pale-skinned kid, punched him in the face and kept running. And
oh my
just,
God.
You know, as a...
Scary.
You know, so, of course, we called the police as soon as this happened, and the police came out, and they basically said, if this had been the other way around, this would be on the news. But because you are in a Pakistani area and you are the minority, and there's so much tension right now because of all this sort of stuff, we just recommend that you not say anything and not press charges. And at that point, I started to think, you know, wait a minute. This is not where we want to be. And it was at that point that I started talking to people and listening to their experiences. And the experience is pretty much similar in that nobody wants to rock the boat. Nobody wants to be the person who's anti-Asian. No one wants to be the person who's anti-Muslim. And so in the sort of idea of tolerance, we have overcompensated by giving them way more power and way more entitlements than they would have if they were just a regular citizen. We've sort of overcompensated. And things have gone crazy. And so when there is a problem, they take to the streets. And they, you know, they put up signs. You know, if I went out and held up a sign that said, kill Ahmadinejad, or, you know, Muslims go home, or that sort of thing, I'd be attacked. But they held up signs that said, death to America, death to Bush, to, you know, all this sort of thing. And it was just an accepted thing. And I just, unfortunately, the world as a whole has for so long tried to give this sort of happy kumbaya attitude of everyone is the same and everyone is equal,
sure,
that they have overcompensated. And we have essentially created this monster ourselves by not making everybody that comes into the United States adhere to the same rules. We have
and assimilate.
More power.
Yeah.
And it's our fault.
Yeah.
It is absolutely our fault.
Oh, yeah, and political correctness is—it's a disease. I believe it was Tom Tancredo that said it's going to kill us all, and that's so true.
And at the end of the day, I wrote a piece about profiling not very long ago. And at the end of the day, there's a reason that you profile. There's a reason that you look at people's behavior and their belief system, and you judge accordingly, because that's how people have protected themselves from the beginning of time. And if you don't act in an appropriate way for wherever it is that you are, then you deserve to be singled out.
Right.
But, you know, but we've gone so overboard with catering to every sort of wackadoodle idea that people have that now we have this huge mess of a problem. And, it breaks my heart because I love New York. I absolutely love New York. And it breaks my heart to see that after, you know, we're starting to recover from 9/11. And still, you know, if you're a New Yorker, you know that if you are in most of downtown, you get your bearings based on where the World Trade Center is. You know, you get lost downtown,
yeah,
and you look up and you see the World Trade Center and you know what direction you're going. And there's just you look up and there's nothing there now. And it's like a sucking chest wound even these years later.
Right.
The idea that...
Now they want to rub salt into the wound with this mock proposal.
And this guy's a bad guy. I mean, he's a slumlord. He doesn't
horrible.
Pay his taxes. You know, this is not somebody who's reaching out, you know, to the community. This is certainly not the way you do it. And I think most Muslims in the United States feel the same way. You know, we've got because my mother is involved in university, she was a professor for many, many years, then we know a lot of people that work in the sort of foreign language departments. And every Muslim that we know has said, good grief, they couldn't do anything worse for our community. They could not, you know, if you thought of a way to make the situation between Muslims and Americans or Christians or Jews worse, you couldn't have found a way. Which it really comes back to, I think a lot of this has to do with the techniques of warfare. You know, Obama tried very hard to make a black versus white warfare. That didn't really work out so well. He then tried class warfare. You know, well, people were angry at Wall Street for a while, but for the most part, people understand that, you know, this was not a Wall Street versus Main Street problem. This was a government intervention problem.
Exactly. Well, I want to point out, too, that Wall Street donated, 70% of Wall Street supported Obama. So
I don't think that's going to happen.
But go ahead, I'm sorry.
I don't think that's going to happen this time around. But
no, I don't think so.
Yeah, but, you know, and so that didn't work either. So now what do we have? We have religious warfare. And, you know, unfortunately that's becoming much, much more successful because then people go to the smaller communities where you know, there's a small religious group and they attack them because it's too dangerous to go to New York and attack them there. And unfortunately it just creates a situation that's a million times worse than it needs to be. They should have just said no. They had the power to say no then. They should have just said no, and none of this would have been an issue.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Alexandria, I'm so sad that we're running low on time, but please tell everyone again your website. I did post it in the chat room, and also how they can get your book, and I definitely want to bring you on again when we can devote the full hour.
Thank you. Well, I can talk forever. So my name is Alexandria Merrill, and that's Alexandrea. Merrill is Merrell.com. So I post almost daily stuff that's going on around the world and political information. I'm also working on a documentary right now that people can participate in. It's called Sick Medicine, and it's about how people are already being affected by the Obamacare initiatives. People are already having their benefits cut, their medical access to medical care cut. And I talk about the NHS and how that was a horrendous failure in the UK. And so I'm happy to talk to people that are having experiences right now. So you go to my website and you can find out about that as well. You can check me out on Facebook. And the book is available at bookstores and online retailers, and you can get it in hardback or paperback or in Kindle. So I would love to hear from people, and I'm so happy to have been on your show. I'm sorry that I wasn't here the whole hour.
Listen, I understand. Well, I definitely want to bring you back, so we will discuss that soon on doing a repeat. Because I loved your column on the feminist, and next time you're on, maybe we can have a more in-depth discussion about that as well. All right, Alexandria, have a great evening.
Thank you so much. Okay,
bye-bye. Take care. All right, everyone, that was Alexandria Merrill. Please check out her book, Rules for Republican Radicals. She's a fabulous guest, and I'm definitely going to bring her back on. I understand with her book tours and everything, the schedule that she's on, so things got a little crazy, and she wasn't able to call in until about half hour into the show. But I encourage everyone to please bookmark her site and check it out every day because she has a lot of excellent commentary. So I want to thank you all again for listening to the Liberty Bell Hour this evening, and please join me next week when my guest will be April Robbins, founder of Red River Writers, a really fascinating woman, also happens to be a conservative, but I want to talk to her a little bit more about being an entrepreneur and, you know, maybe the political scene in terms of that. So April is a children's author, but in her previous life she was an IT person, really has a degree in computer science and is an excellent writer and a well-known children's author. So you'll definitely want to tune in for that. So thank you once again, everyone. Have a great week and keep the faith. See you then.
Delicate melody, but I say I like the bruises, 'cause a melody don't mean a thing if we don't have the strength to sing, and I won't be made to ever feel ashamed. something we need changing. As if all the founding fathers seem to get it wrong. But I say, I still believe in the greatest liberator, innovator, cultivator, freedom knows. So I suggest you take inside, 'cause I think you changed already. You went and lost your pride. But I'm American made. I got American parts. I got American faith in American heart. You go on. Got American faith in America's heart. Go on.